Hello, and welcome to the PC Pro podcast on what is the UK's only summery day of the year, I suspect. So we're all here sitting cooped inside next to our microphones, and I hope that possibly you're listening to this whilst enjoying a lovely walk in the fresh air. With me today, I have Darian Grunsmith.
Hello.
And also Barry Collins.
Hello, Tim.
Hello. So we're back to our regular three. Whether you consider that good or bad news, I'd like you to keep to yourself. Right.
Hot on hot.
It is hot, Barry. If you haven't noticed that, then you're in trouble. We're going to start, Darian, with an Intel virus revolution.
Yes, revolution is probably what they're hoping we'll say about it. The reality might be a little bit more mundane. Intel got a bloody nose not that long ago when it was revealed, as you know, that the two design flaws dubbed Spectre and Meltdown could leak confidential or private sensitive information, could make it possible for rogue processes to access data they weren't supposed to, and fixes and patches have been rolling out for that ever since. Intel's now announced, speaking at RSA San Francisco, it's going to do more to improve security going forward. It's not a revolution. Let's be clear about this. It's a quite clever innovation. What they're going to do is they've come up with a way of, when you do a virus scan, you know, I'm sure you know the frustration of you're working on a spreadsheet or you're playing Doom or whatever it is you do, and it kicks in and suddenly your computer starts to judder and jitter because your CPU is suddenly being eaten up by the antivirus software that's scanning all the processes in memory and inspecting your disk. Intel had what I think one publication described as a light bulb moment, because it is a really good and obvious idea. They've released a framework, or they're about to release a framework, so you can do your virus scanning on the GPU instead of on the CPU. Now, obviously, I guess if you are actually playing Doom at the time, that's not necessarily going to be good news. But for most of us who will be sitting using a desktop application, that's brilliant. They've reported that it should cut CPU utilization during a virus scan from 20%, which they had before using, I think it was Windows Defender, to, quote, as little as 2%.
Okay, so that's with Doom. What about if you're using a more modern game like Quake 3?
Doom's not that. I actually fell for this myself recently. There was a re-release of Doom not that many years ago, and a re-release of Tomb Raider, which I somehow passed me by. And I was talking to Catherine Byrne at Computer Shopper a year or so ago, and she was saying, "Oh yeah, I've been benchmarking everything with Tomb Raider," and I sort of thought it was a joke. I'm like, "What, 640 by 480 with 256 colors?" But no, Doom is apparently like a real thing that you might actually be playing in 2018, believe it or not. Anyway, that tangent aside, the good news about this is also it's not just for new customers. It's a new feature which is going to be available on 6th, 7th and 8th generation processors. So there's a good chance that you'll get it as an update if you've bought a computer in the past couple of years. So that's nice.
And are we talking mobile processors as well as desktop processors?
I don't see any reason why not. I mean, they've all got the same built-in GPUs. In fact, it's a good point that you raised there. There's a couple of other things they announced, and one of the other things was a new framework which is called Intel Security Essentials. Now, the likes of you and me are not going to have to know about this, but basically, it standardizes Intel's on-chip security features. So they're going to be going forward. They're going to be consistent across the whole stack from Atom up to Core and Xeon stuff, so that it will just be easier and more consistent for security software to take advantage of the various built-in technologies that Intel already has to stymie viruses and the like. Yeah, I can tell you're excited about that one.
I think Tim's died.
Oh, heavens.
I think he's been hit by some antivirus software.
Died with excitement.
I'm back. Everything just buffered there for a second. But anyway, I'm back with you. I have had a slump in the past 2 days, so if I do disappear, for once, it's not actually the fault of my computer. It's the fault of BT, of which more later. So I missed what you said, but I'm sure it was...
Oh, it was brilliant, yeah.
Some of his best work this year.
Wouldn't be hard.
Is two things here. Does the software itself need to be recompiled to use this GPU.
Yeah, the software will need to know about it, and Windows Defender is going to have it almost instantly. I think it's going to have that from next month or so. And Intel says it's very soon. Maybe next month is an exaggeration. I haven't got the date in front of me, but I remember seeing it and thinking, "Oh, that's quick." And then Intel's going to work with other big industry names to get it rolled out across the board.
Okay. Because the other thing is, it doesn't strike me as like a problem in 2018. I know I'm sitting here with a Core i7 laptop on my desk, and that's my Honeywell moment for the podcast. But I don't remember the last time I was sat there thinking, "Oh, this scan's really ruining the performance of my PC."
No, well, you can look at it.
I don't see it, but it doesn't strike me as a modern day problem, really.
Well, yeah, it may not be a huge problem for the likes of us who have laptops that we've bought ones that are powerful enough to do our daily work on. But I can see it being beneficial to the light end of the market. And the other thing that's worth mentioning is we don't have any figures on this yet, but it is suspected that using the GPU should also be more power efficient than using the CPU. So it's possible that you'll be able to eke a little bit of extra battery life out of your laptop using this. Although, knowing Intel, I've got to say, if it were going to give you an extra 2%, they'd probably be shouting that from the rooftops. So perhaps that is an optimistic assessment.
So are you excited by this, Darian?
Well, I, to be really honest...
He's not slept since Tuesday.
Of course I'm not excited. I mean, you'd have to be a real particular sort of nerd to get chills about the idea of a virus scan using your GPU instead of your CPU. But I am quite pleased, partly because it's just really nice to... Well, first of all, it's a nice bit of lateral thinking. It's always nice when somebody comes up with an elegant improvement which uses the resources we already have in a smarter way. And secondly, it's nice because, I'm sure you remember commissioning no end about 5 years ago of features on how GPU computing was going to transform the way we did things as soon as someone came up with a use for it other than video transcoding. And it's been a bit of a squib ever since. And it's just nice to see, that those, the GPU technology, someone's found another useful thing to do with it.
The only thing that strikes me on this, though, if this is designed after the security flaws and whatever, wouldn't it be possible now for an attacker just to attack the GPU and disable the GPU and then effectively knock out your antivirus? Whereas before, if you knocked out the CPU, then you'd notice the whole computer would collapse. I wonder if now it's going to be possible to have a sort of very isolated attack on the GPU that you wouldn't notice in day-to-day process, and that could actually be very dangerous.
Well, you've got to hope that the scanner would be smart enough to see the GPU wasn't available and fall back on the CPU. I mean, but that's down to implementation.
Mm.
There's one other thing about this that Intel announced, which was could be a bit controversial, so I thought maybe this would be a good thing to mention as well. At the third leg of the security stool it's unveiled, is called Advanced Platform Telemetry, which we don't really know anything much about it at the moment, but it's a new system which is intended to make it faster and easier for Intel systems to share hardware and presumably software data with cloud servers. And the way it's been presented is they said that we're going to use this sort of rapid, simple telemetry along with machine learning to help improve threat detection and reduce false positives. Needless to say, everybody who was on the call immediately jumped in and said, "Well, hang on, what exactly are you going to be sharing with whom?" To which Rick Echevarria, the VP of Intel's Software and Services Group, replied, "Privacy is an important design point in anything we do. I won't get into the details of everything we're providing, but in general, he said, very, very encouraging phrase, data is anonymized and generalized." So there's, make of that what you will.
I do like, by which I mean, I'm bewildered by another of his statements, which was, "Today's cybersecurity landscape is constantly evolving with emerging threats, which means we must be vigilant in delivering solutions that protect customers and their data."
Oh, you didn't throw an actors in there.
It's the most generic
security bingo bit of actors.
Exactly. Actors and vectors and he'd have the whole set.
Yeah. That's true. But he could have said generic. That at any point in the past 20 years, probably more.
Yeah,
but it's not false.
It's dinner party.
Well, you know what you're getting. You don't have to worry about him going off script and starting talking about iffy, contentious subjects.
He's no John McAfee, is he?
Yeah.
No, I'm not sure he'd make my dinner party list either, for a different reason.
Oh, Intel bought McAfee. They must have liked something there.
Yeah, well, you know that he'd washed his hands of the company long before that. When he did actually resurface a couple of years ago with those slightly balmy videos from Central America, I happened to be talking to Symantec, and I said, "Are you worried that Peter Norton's going to do the same?" But they said, very diplomatically, they said, "I think something along the lines of Peter Norton is a very responsible character who wouldn't do something like that."
No. I think of the three of us, I think only Barry is a likely candidate for that kind of thing. And what about Spectre and Meltdown? We haven't really... this all got a bit quiet on that front. Did they mention anything about increasing security from that point of view?
Well, you've caught me on the hop there. This wasn't on the agenda, but I mean, the short answer is the patches are out there, and we are to understand that they work and they do affect performance in certain circumstances. I haven't delved into it myself, to be honest with you. It hasn't been a huge issue since the initial disclosure. I mean, the thing about the weaknesses, the vulnerabilities, is that they were real, but it was kind of highly theoretical. You'd have to have exactly the right confluence of circumstances to actually be able to exploit it. So although once the information was out there, it was certainly a risk that needed to be addressed. I'm not aware of it having actually been, you know, the cause of any big scandals. I think, you know, as I say, now the patches are out there and nobody is, you know, some people are saying, oh, it's affected my performance, but it hasn't done it to such an extent that, you know, customers are taking their laptops back saying it's ground to a halt. So I think I'm afraid that one's going to just quietly die a death.
Not sure if it's just, I can't definitively linked the two, but I've noticed a lot more fan activity on my laptop of late, and I'm not just talking about the last 2 days. I mean, it's been very warm. I wonder if it is related to that or something else, but
I think that's breaking news. Barry, increase in fan noise.
Yes.
I think that's incontrovertible evidence, isn't it, really?
When you said you noticed an increase in fan activity, I honestly thought for a moment you meant people on Twitter defending Intel, you know, popping up saying, nah, they wouldn't get this wrong.
All right, let's move on to another company that's just as innovative as Intel.
Innovative.
It also begins with I. Barry, would you care to fill in the gaps?
Yeah, I'm not sure I go quite as far as innovative, because IKEA have released its first Bluetooth speaker. So IKEA has been gradually getting into the technology market over the past year or so. It has a series of smart lights and plugs out. The smart lights are actually in my front room at present, and if I had my Alexa on and shouted at it in the right terms, I could turn my lights on, and, you know, isn't the world a greatest place for that? But now it has released these two Bluetooth speakers called Enerby, which is a little close to enemy for my liking. But anyway, they are in two sizes, which are 8x8 and 12x12 inch. And they're just sort of very boxy Bluetooth speakers. There's nothing really much to say about them other than, why is IKEA getting into this market, really? I'm sort of struggling to understand it.
They're not even smart, are they?
Not really, no. They're just Bluetooth speakers. I mean, there's literally all there is to them. They can sort of slot into... They're designed to slot into IKEA shelving units. So if you've got one of those boxy, squared-off shelving units, one of these things will slip in like a gem. But other than that, that's about it. They're 80 quid for the smaller one, and the bigger one is 110, I believe. He says, struggling to find it on the site. But there you go.
I don't share your...
Sorry, I've got it wrong. It's £45 and £80, not 80 and 110.
Sorry, thank you, Tim. I'm sorry for talking over you, but I was outraged to hear, like, just the dismissive tone of Barry's voice. I think this is a great thing. Well, to explain, I'm not sure that this itself is a great product, although I do like the design of it, actually. I do think it's quite attractive. I think what's important is that IKEA is not PC World. I think it's great that IKEA is bringing these smart technologies, or in this case, you know, I call it a connected technology, you know, bringing technology to a different kind of marketplace and exposing people to it who, you know, would be less likely to go shopping for a Bluetooth speaker. But once they see it in IKEA, once they see the smart lights there, once they see the speaker and it says, you know, play music from your phone or whatever, I think actually IKEA is really important for supporting the growth of, you know, connected or semi-smart technologies. And I you know, I wish IKEA made more kind of high-tech stuff, because I think it's really going to drive adoption in a way that no quantity of, you know, of shiny things sitting in PC World or sitting on Amazon is going to do.
Really? I mean, I'll give you that on the lights, but on Bluetooth speakers? I mean, my dad's had a Bluetooth speaker for 5 years, and my dad's not exactly the vanguard of technology. You don't need to walk into IKEA to have heard of a Bluetooth speaker.
Well, all right. Did he come to the idea on his own, or did you have anything to do with that?
No, but I mean, it's not exactly a cutting-edge technology. I think Bluetooth has managed to pervade people's living rooms without IKEA's help. I completely agree on the lights, and it sort of makes sense for IKEA to be in that game, because it's, you know, it sells lighting products, and if you get them, you might as well get that all in one hit. And, you know, I'm not saying there's any harm in IKEA selling these things. I'm just not convinced it's the great breakthrough that we were.
Well, maybe what I mean is, it's not just about them being available in IKEA as opposed to you having to go to a technology shop to buy them. It's more about the angle of design, where they're coming from. You know, as I say, PC World, just example top of my head, you go there to buy technology, and the things you will see often, you know, do look quite high tech, shiny. And IKEA is coming at it from a different angle, and design is very. You know, it's very home friendly. I can really see people who've never before been interested in Bluetooth speakers, who've been interested in Bluetooth speakers but have never seen one that speaks to them, looking at the Enerby and going, "Yes, actually, I think that would go nicely in my kitchen." And that, and so it's kind of like it's a normalization, and it's a thing which makes technology more accessible because of where it's coming from and because of what its priorities are, rather than perhaps because it just puts it in front of a different audience.
I do know what you mean. I must admit, I was slightly more excited by the other IKEA story that I spotted this week, which Darren spotted this week, which was the robot that assembled the IKEA chair. I'm just actually watching it as I talk to you now again. And it's these people in Singapore, University of Singapore.
They have far too much time on their hands.
Well, the students, aren't they?
But it's really but it is incredibly clever how they're using sensors and all the various robotics technology so they can delicately lift each part of this chair and then it can be assembled from scratch to the fully assembled thing in 9 minutes.
That's robots make cars. They make everything. It is not that impressive that a robot is making a wooden chair about six different parts.
I know what you mean, but it's not one robot that makes a car. A robot gets pushed along an assembly line to do a very specific job. It's different for a robot to be taught this very flexible task. So I take your point, but I rebuff it, Darren.
I don't know what the end goal is here. I mean, you're going to go to IKEA, buy your chair, then buy the robot next to it to assemble it for you, or you could just go and buy a chair.
What excited me about this is it's exactly as you're saying. Now, you can get robots that make cars, but this is much more going in the direction of a general purpose robot that can actually do more than one thing. It's not, you know, custom designed for making carburetors or whatever. Exactly. And looking at the pictures of it, which you can easily find online, there it's not really small and practical enough for you to have one around your house at the moment. But I do very much like the idea that in time we could have a general purpose assembly robot, which we could, you know, keep in the cupboard under the stairs next to the Hoover or whatever. Of course, the Hoover's very outdated, next to the Roomba. And you know, you could literally not just buy, you know, a flat pack chair from IKEA. You could buy a load of planks of wood and a box of screws and just tell it, make me a table or whatever, and it could go off and do that. It's a little way off, I admit.
Mobile assembly plant.
Well, why not?
Go to one of those awkward shop things and buy the thing you wanted in the first place.
But it's so much less efficient. This is far future stuff now. I mean, this is decades and decades in the future. But I mean, the idea that someone would have to make, you know, a particular chair and then ship it, you know, as a chair shaped item rather than as the much, much more compact, much more efficient raw materials. That's very outdated thinking. And actually, already, I mean, the robots are definitely not going to do it in the short term. But, you know, IKEA owns TaskRabbit. So you can already get, you know, the ultimate general purpose automaton, i.e. a person, to come along and assemble your IKEA furniture for you. And you can also get a woodworker there. You can get someone to come along and build you a table if you really want.
I'm with Darren. I think Barry, you know, Barry's just stuck in this old way of thinking, and you know, we've got to look to the future. Did you ever see that that robot that that Sasha filmed at the CES Asia event, Barry? That cooked the meal for you.
Yeah, I vaguely recall it. Yeah.
But this is the kind of thing that we're moving towards.
No, we're not.
No, Barry, slowly. I'm not saying we're going to be there within 5 years. I'm talking exactly like Dario. I'm talking about, you know, we're talking generations away. But this is the final mile, the last mile, if you like, the equivalent of the last mile bit of technology, whereby these things can actually genuinely help you in the home and do amazing things.
Okay, you boys, you carry on with your self-assembly robots. I'll just go down the shops if that's okay. Or order it from Amazon. But best of luck.
Michael Deere on Mixlr asks, who assembles the robot? And it'll be the robot next door that assembles the robot. Mm. So, you know, this is the future, guys. This is where it's all going. You heard it here first in the PC Pro podcast, 19th of April, 2018. But Barry won't be eating his hat, because a robot will be eating his hat on his behalf. But in decades to come, I can assure you that. Barry, you know, yes. How you didn't really want to talk about IKEA, and we talked about having something else instead.
Yes.
Should we talk briefly about the slight, I don't know, is it wrong to say madness? The crazy letter from Jeff Bezos to share owners, not shareholders, but share owners.
Yes, why not? So this was part of Amazon's annual wrap-up of its earnings. And probably the highlight of that was that Amazon Prime now has 100 million subscribers worldwide. I'm not quite sure how many countries Prime's in. I think it's certainly a good few. But nevertheless, that's a pretty healthy business when you're managing to scrape 80 quid a year or the equivalent from 100 million people. No wonder Mr. Bezos can afford a new pair of sunglasses. Anyway, he gave us a sort of lecture, really, which you can find on their website, which was sent to all the shareholders, explaining how things are done in Amazon. Now, from the outside, Amazon looks like a pretty strange high maintenance company to work in. I'm sure we've all read stories about life inside Amazon, both for the grunts down on the factory level and for the high level execs. And this gives you some kind of insight into Bezos's management style. One of the things I found particularly weird was the way they handle meetings. So apparently, before you go into any kind of high powered meeting at Amazon, you're instructed to write a narrative structured 6-page memo. According to Jeff, we silently read one at the beginning of each meeting in a kind of study hall. Not surprisingly, the quality of these memos varies widely. Some have the clarity of angels singing. They are brilliant and thoughtful and set up the meeting for high quality discussion. Sometimes they come in at the other end of the spectrum. And I imagine if you come in at the other end of the spectrum, you're in a whole heap of Jeff. It's basically about how Amazon keeps executing high standards. And he keeps reemphasizing this point that Amazon has to keep maintaining high standards, and that the standards change all the time. He says, one thing I love about customers is that they are divinely discontent. Their expectations are never static. They go up. It's human nature. We didn't ascend from our hunter-gatherer days by being satisfied. People have a voracious appetite for a better way, and yesterday's wow quickly becomes today's ordinary. Anyone who's ever read anything about Amazon culture knows that it's a very sort of high-performance, driven, high-pressure environment, and everything I read here doesn't change my opinion of that one iota.
I loved the section about handstands. Did you read that bit?
Mm. Yes.
A close friend recently decided to learn to do a perfect freestanding handstand. I mean, heck, who doesn't do that? So she hired a handstand coach. So he manages to...
Certain amount of disposable income floating around this whimsy, isn't there?
Yeah. I can't think of anything less fruitful to spend money on than that. But there you go. But yes, he manages to take that little nugget and turn it into another, as you say, Barrett, life lesson. And they say, you know, don't think that you can do a perfect handstand in 2 weeks, guys. It takes 6 months of daily practice. Unrealistic beliefs on scope, often hidden and undiscussed, kill high standards. It's just really weird. The whole thing is strange.
He's a strange man.
I have created a link to it for people who want to read along, which is pcpro.link/Bezos2018. So if you want to actually go read the whole, is it a 6-page memo? I think it might be a 6-page memo.
It could well have been when it started.
Yeah, then you can do it. But he is a bit strange, clearly, but you can't really argue with what Amazon has achieved, because it is... okay, Darren, have you read the memo?
No.
Take a guess. How many employees that Amazon has around the world? These are direct employees.
I wouldn't even like to begin to speculate. I don't know. It's a very sort of nimble company, so I'd guess it might be surprisingly low. It might be like 1,000.
That's right. And it's 560,000 employees. You're precisely
there we go.
Correct there.
1,000 employees for Amazon.
Could be a lot of contractors and, you know, a lot of outsourced.
No. I'm sorry, it was the other side of the scale, Darren. I think it's sarcastic.
No, I know. I'm just amazed at Darren's lack of comprehension of multinational corporations.
I think if you're going to be a really big, successful company, one of the things you do is you don't burden yourself with an enormous workforce. I mean, Amazon has obviously made it work, but there's nothing at all ridiculous about the idea that you could run that business by having lots and lots of contracts and agreements. And particularly if you're in lots of countries, you're going to have to deal with, you know, lots of international warehouses and delivery networks anyway. So it makes perfect sense not to own those.
Darren, you worked in a publishing company with like 400 employees. I mean, it's a tiny. This is Amazon. It takes 1,000 people just to clean the place.
Well, yes, if you have an office the size of one of those enormous aircraft hangars. Look, I've explained my reasoning. You can take it or leave it.
Yeah, but I was just amazed. So that in 2017, they created 130,000 new jobs. So that's quite a... That's quite a sizable amount. And this thing is just a phenomenon. If you consider how big Whole Foods is, for example, which it acquired last year, it's just a bullet point within its kind of offering. It's as of nothing, almost. It's just a kind of a by the way, obviously, it's part of its strategy to offer it, but it's just a bullet point. And it's just, this company is just a huge, sprawling being. I was really quite amazed as I read through it. It is worth a read just to get some background on it. Anything to add, guys, before we move on to the next story?
Just that I think, you know, Jeff Bezos obviously is a smart cookie, and I think it's what the memo says to me. I think he really, you know, unsurprisingly, he really nails what is special about Amazon, which is how Always, it's really impressed me over the, 20 years it's been with us. It's always looking a step ahead. When it started, it was a bookshop, and it's just constantly kind of managed to expand and reinvent and innovate. And several times it's done things that that were not necessarily unpredictable, but they've always come sooner than I expected them to come. And I think that's, that any business, or any technology business, can maybe learn from that. The counterpoint perhaps being, you know, the likes of Microsoft and even Apple, who have, to be honest, not really managed to surprise us very many times in recent years.
Yeah, I know we should probably balance this out by saying there has been plenty of negative coverage of Amazon recently as well, particularly in terms of its what do they call them? They have a particular name for their, it's something like a fulfillment associates. I can't remember exactly what they call them, but anyway, all these people who work in the warehouse that have to meet their horrible deadlines and the various things, some of which are not so sanitary by the sounds of things, they need to do to avoid having toilet breaks. Anyway, we won't go too much into that. So it's not all positive from the Amazon coverage front. Right, let's go to the next story, Barry, which is going to be yours. Yes, yeah, nice chance for you to rant. So me and Darren will just sit back as you talk about the worst broadband providers in the UK.
Well, it's let's get the libel lawyers on the line while we start. So this is Ofcom's. They do have one of the few decent pieces of research Ofcom does, actually. It's a examination of the number of complaints that providers in certain areas get. So they do broadband, fixed line telephone, pay TV, all of those. And they do this every quarter. And it allows you to compare how many complaints are received by the major players in each market. And they've done this for quite some time, so now we've got a fair bit of historical data to fall back on. But so the most recent figures for Q4 2017 show that, perhaps to a few people's surprise, TalkTalk are the top of the list for complaints. So they get on average 31 complaints per 100,000 customers, which, when you think about it, is still a reasonably low figure. But it's more than four times higher than the best performer in the market, which is Sky. Sky has been the least complained about of the big six providers for the past 2 years, in fact. And it has just seven complaints per 100,000 customers, at least as when it comes to broadband rather than the rest of its services. So it's just a fairly good indication of the sort of level of service you can expect, the customer service you can expect, if not the speed and the reliability of the lines from broadband providers. BT doesn't do particularly well in this. BT was top of the charts for most of 2016 and 17, but it seems to have improved pretty well. It's now on 27 complaints per 100,000 customers, exactly the same as the BT owned PlusNet, which I rather suspect is a reflection of them sharing call centres, but maybe not. The interesting thing is EE, which was, when this, as far back as the data goes to Q1 2016, EE was the worst of the providers. It's now the second best, and it's gradually come down and down and down since BT bought it. So it's now down to just 12 complaints per 100,000 customers compared to the mothership, which has 27. So if I was BT, I'd be finding home the person who's running their EE call centre and get them to take over in the main one.
Yeah, we should say these are just the big companies. So this is the top six, isn't it? We don't have figures for the smaller companies.
Yeah, there's not. And well, they don't have enough customers, or there's not enough data to reliably track their number of complaints per customer. So it's just the big providers.
Yeah. Okay. Well, there's not much more to say about that, is there, really? Unless you have something you wish to pitch in, Darian?
No, I was saying earlier on, I mean, I'm afraid the thing about broadband is very few people have kind of meaningful comparative experiences of using, you know, more than one or at most two providers, because you just don't hop back and forth in the course of a day, as it were. I was with Sky for several years. I was happy with them, then moved to Virgin. I'm happy with them. That's my exciting story.
That's a great story.
Thanks.
Yeah, have you got more?
I've got a story about about my phone provider. That was Sky as well, and I was happy with that. But then we switched
to Virgin.
Yeah.
Wow. This is classic. This is award-winning stuff here that we're talking.
Oh, to be fair, Darren, Sky and Virgin are the two most consistent performers in the entire survey. So you may just have fluked out onto two good providers.
Yeah. Well, I did a little bit of research.
Anecdotally, Virgin is probably the most moaned about company in my Twitter timeline, at least. But it seems not, according to Ofcom's research.
It seems like...
Well, also, you just have to be quite wary about Twitter and the like, because what's good about this Ofcom survey is that it's per 100,000. And often, if you just did it by sheer number of complaints, which is what Twitter tells you, then you're not getting a proper reflection. So maybe that's part of it.
I don't know for sure, but I would guess that that reflects a company where where 99% of the time everything is fine. But if it does go wrong, it's not very responsive, or it doesn't handle it very well. So the complaints you do get are quite vocal and protracted, would be my guess.
The other thing I think is worth bearing in mind, and in defence of TalkTalk and perhaps BT, is that TalkTalk is right at the value end of the market. with some of the cheaper lines and stuff. So it's conceivable that it has a less technically savvy audience than maybe Virgin, maybe Sky. That might be clutching at straws, but I think it's conceivable.
Fair point. Okay, all right, let's zoom along to the next story to discuss, which is, he said, desperately trying to find the point in his Slack stream. It's that thing down, you know that thing, you know, where people don't speak like English quite so well as they used to.
OMG, I mean, lol, WTF, yes. In fact, to be honest, those abbreviations I'm using show how behind the times I am, because that's not that's not what it's about anymore. It is about emoji. So YouTube have recently published the results of a survey they did. I don't know why YouTube in particular did this. I guess because they have a very large number of people commenting, leaving semi-literate things underneath videos. Because YouTube carried out a survey. They asked 2,000 people what they thought about the use of English these days, and 94% of YouTubers agreed with the sentiment that there's been a decline in the correct use of English. I don't think there was a time attached, actually, just in general. And 4 out of 5 people said it was most pronounced among young people. So this has been blamed by the survey makers and by the news agencies that reported it on the rise of emoji, because it's also been found it's correlated with the huge increase in popularity of, you know, the little icons that that now, and I never asked for them, but now they pop up in Google Keyboard, they pop up in, you know, all the little apps I use. So it is easy to use emoji. It is, according to one measure, the fastest growing language in history, if you can call it a language, which I don't think you can. But this has prompted some rather snippy comments from people who who will basically, as far as I can see, maybe showing my hand here, are just looking for an excuse to have a good old moan. So Chris McGovern, who is chairman of the Campaign for Real Education, which is itself a very aggressive name for an organisation, says there has unquestionably been quite a serious decline in young people's ability to use the English language and to write properly punctuated English. We are moving in a direction of cartoon and picture language, which will inevitably affect literacy. Emoji convey a message, but this breeds laziness. So that's the message that we're being fed, that emoji are bad.
The only thing I'd say is that I've got one child who's still in Key Stage 2, as they call it now, so junior school, and the things that she knows about English grammar, particularly the naming of all the different parts of the of grammar, which I was never taught, so I've never really picked all of these things up. I know you're much better at this, Darian. She is very good. Her grasp of grammar is arguably just as good as mine.
Well, this is good old Michael Gove, isn't it, with the national curriculum, which now requires kids to study English, you know, grammatically, as if it were almost as if it were a foreign language or an academic study, which is quite controversial, particularly because you may have seen on Facebook and Twitter, people have been circulating examples of the exercises that kids have to do. This has nothing to do with computing, but it's just, as an aside, they're having to, like, get to grips with some really abstract, obscure grammatical concepts, which, you know, grown-ups and people like myself, you know, I would consider myself a fairly competent writer, but I don't recognize some of the grammatical constructs and concepts which kids are being drilled in. So it should be no surprise that kids can identify a deponent clause or whatever. But what they're actually choosing to do when they're communicating with each other is completely ignore all this and use emoji. Now, there was another report on this. I think this one might have been in the Telegraph, which I thought was very interesting, because the journalist actually spoke to some kids and asked them for their view, which I don't think YouTube actually did. And one of the kids said that it's much easier to communicate in emoji because it's much more immediate, it's colourful, and it's in your face. And I realised, you know, of course that makes perfect sense, because what emoji are doing is they are standing in for body language. You send somebody a picture of a smile because they can't see that you're actually smiling. And I think, you know, far from being, you know, a challenge to literacy, I actually think this is a very, you know, good and creative and powerful bit of evolution, which, you know, really elevates online discourse.
And I actually love emoji for one simple reason. They are the single best way to end an online conversation. not because you've been really offensive or anything, but just because it's a way to say, right, well, I don't really have anything more to say now. But so let's just finish. This is all good. Speak to you later. And it manages to convey that with, a tongue sticking out. So
yeah. If anyone went and analysed the use of emojis on the PC Pro Slack channel, they would find that the thumbs up symbol is used probably more often than any other word or symbol.
I'm on the campaign for Real Education website, and I've just read two pages, and they've made about 3 or 4 spelling and grammatical errors in it so far. So I'll be pointing that out to them when I'm finished with this.
I think also in emojis. Emojis defense, they can also convey some subtle meanings that that words can't.
Or you very much. There is a whole, and I don't know if it's been properly academically studied, but if it hasn't, I'm sure it will be. The problem is it's so fast moving, actually. There is a whole sort of dialect that's kind of evolved in the context of online communications. I saw a thing the other day. There was a blog post from a kid who was explaining the difference between, say, I forget exactly what it was, using a capital letter and using a full stop at the end. They convey different tones. There's all these different sort of real subtleties and nuances, which I suspect the likes of the Campaign for Real Education, just to pick on them as a, you know, as a handy punch bag. I don't really know much about them, but you know, people like that who are not impressed by the state of online discourse will just overlook, will not recognize that, and in fact there is an enormous amount of literacy going on. It's just not in the traditional form which we, you know, which we inherit from our Victorian ancestors.
What was the motivation for this research? Why did YouTube do it?
Yeah, do you know, I honestly don't know. I tried to find the original report and I couldn't dig it up, so it's a bit of a mystery.
Oh, there's a surprise.
Yeah.
It sounds like a PR story just spun out of it.
Yeah, I did actually check my press release inbox to see if it had been like spams to everybody in the industry, but I don't qualify, apparently.
And what is your favourite emoji, Barry? I'm sure you must have one.
Well, see, you say it's not a language in itself, but if you ever end up in a WhatsApp group with non-league footballers, it is entirely a language in itself, trust me. And I don't understand half of what those emoji mean. There is a very subtle sort of sub-language that's used that I'm often blinded by. But this is patent nonsense, headline-grabbing cruft from whoever put this story out. It's just... Let's move on.
There's one interesting thing I'd like to share about emoji, though. I didn't realise this at all. I should have done. I should have put two and two together. I happen to have a friend who is fluent in Japanese and lived in Japan for many years. And, of course, emoji started out in Japan. And there's a lot of emoji which actually have specific cultural meanings in Japan that we don't understand. Now, I'm trying to remember what they are, but there's lots of things. Like, if you look through... I mean, when you say what's your favourite emoji, you picture, you know, the really obvious ones, the thumbs up, the poo, the smiley face. But if you scroll through on your phone... There's entire categories of food and geography and kind of, you know, sometimes quite hard to understand hand gestures. There's like that one which some people think it's praying, some people think it's clapping. And those actually, you know, those are distinct cultural concepts which have been imported onto our phones wholesale. And there's a whole sub-language there which you can learn, but when you're exchanging with your friends, you're actually, you know, kind of you're hacking, you're jamming, you're subverting the original intended meanings of these. And evolving new ones. And I, you know, again, from a linguistics point of view, I think that's really fascinating. I leave you speechless with these insights.
Barry, I have a message for you from Mixler, from Potster, who says, Barry, mate, the sun is shining. Cheer up.
Wow. Great. Thank you. And there's probably a little sun emoji he's going to put in that message. But anyway.
Okay. All right. We'll think of something to make Barry happier. How about this news, Barry? Tomorrow, there's going to be a huge splurge of AMD Ryzen 2 stories because the AMD's new process is about to launch with benchmarks and all the rest of it. Does that make you happy?
Not really, no.
It's good. I've seen some early benchmarks, and it's a promising looking chip. That's all I'll say. If I was Intel, I'd definitely be more focused on security right now rather than performance, because There's some very good news in there for AMD. Anyway, that's all tomorrow. Don't listen to that today, that last sentence, because I'm probably breaking some kind of NDA by even suggesting that.
You just benchmarked it a bit quicker than it needed to be. You did break it.
Yeah, that's true. Roughly 12%. Anyway, this is a question from Michael Deere from last week as well, which we didn't have time to fit in. But, you know, Which and Tesco have closed their email services. Are you aware of this or are closing them?
No.
they're branded variants of the name of IoT or something else.
Well, quite possibly. But anyway, they're closing down. But where do we think that people should go other than is there any realistic alternative to Gmail?
Another one where very few people will have an informed opinion, because once you've settled on one email account, obviously you're not going to hop between that and other major ones. So to be honest, it has kind of withered away. I haven't really been paying attention. I've had my Gmail account for, 15 years now. I was one of the very first to get on board. That bit of a brag there. I couldn't even tell you if Hotmail's still going. Oh, it became Outlook.com, didn't it?
No, it's Outlook. It's Outlook.com now, which is actually a good service, and in some ways a better service than Gmail. I think its user interface in terms of the actual the web interface is more attractive, and you're more likely to be able to get a name closer to your own, because as you say, Darren, it's been going for a long time and everyone has a Gmail address.
Yes,
even Barry's dog probably has a Gmail address.
Is your dog probably on Gmail?
It is actually weird how webmail has remained largely static, isn't it? There really is only Outlook and Gmail still going. I know there was a good tweet yesterday from Helen Lewis from the Spectator, who said she overheard in the office someone saying, "Why would you even marry somebody with a Yahoo mail address?" But it is a market where almost no new entrants in it for the past 10-15 years. But I wouldn't look beyond Gmail. I've got an Outlook address as well, mainly because Microsoft forces you to have it to log into Windows. But that's about it.
Yeah, well, you can get away with that from Windows. And we do. The one thing I would say, if anyone is still using their ISP's email, I would move away from it, because they are definitely being degraded over time. If I was BT or whoever, I'd not be spending any money whatsoever on my email service. So I'd be, people should be moving away. Not
you should have your own domain.
So, sorry?
You should have your own domain. Our reader should.
Yeah. Yeah, well, yes, you can do that, and then you can actually use Gmail. I know I've written about that before. But
conversely, did you see the news this week that Gmail's getting a redesign and a load of new features?
Yes.
So the
self-destructing email thing.
Yep. And boomerangy, snoozy things. So if an email comes in at a bad time, you can say, "I want to see this again in 3 hours."
Yeah, and they've been around for ages.
Not in Gmail though. So
because you can get various mobile apps that do that with your Gmail account.
Well, all right, but now everyone's going to have it, whether they want it or not. and improved offline support too.
Well. Thanks for that in 2018, yeah.
So the conclusion is, if you want to move away, have a look at Gmail, have a look at Outlook, have a look at hosting your own website, or having your own website and setting up your own email using that. So
you don't even need your own website. You can just run a domain for the email. That's what I would do.
Yeah. It is surprisingly easy to do, and it's not super. But you can probably do it for what? I guess it's just the basic hosting cost.
Yeah, yeah, 10 a year.
So, yeah. All right. Anyway, that was only meant to be a very quick question. I apologize for it going on for 5 minutes. If you were bored, if you were interested, I don't apologize at all. It was inspired. All right. Let's move on to our final topic of this week, which is this product that I have before me. And that product is, I'll see if I can open it for you. That's a sound of a phone opening, which is the Gemini PDA. This is the sound of what makes it unique, because it has a keyboard, very much reminiscent of the Scion Series 5. In fact, that's no shock, because the chap, I can't recall his name, but anyway, the guy who designed that keyboard is actually on the board of directors for the parent company. So if you owned a Series 5 and you've been hankering after that keyboard design for 10 years, then good news, you can buy the Gemini PDA for, do you know how much this costs, guys? Anybody?
Well, the original Scion Series 5, I think, was about £300. So, you know, cateris paribus, I'm going to say the same.
Okay. Barry, I don't know if you've done any research or can remember from the magazine.
It's about £600, wasn't it, now?
It is £599, yes. So it is very much placing itself.
Spot on with my numbers this week, aren't I? End.
Yeah. Well, at least you were closer in terms of orders of magnitude. You were definitely closer this time. So, £600 for a phone that has a built-in keyboard. So, as I say, it's a clamshell design, so it closes so you can then slip it in your pocket and carry it around with you. I have to say, it's a reasonably slim design, much slimmer than the Series 5MX I have also sitting before me. It doesn't feel that terrible in your jeans pocket, let's say, but it is substantially more lumpy than a traditional phone. So you can't really get away from that. It's about 50% as thick again, plus it's a chunk taller than a typical phone.
Well, I used to carry my Series 5 around in a trouser pocket, and admittedly it was the 90s and I had big pleats, but it was doable. So.
There's your next band name, Darren. Darren and the Big Pleats.
Yes.
Yeah, you'd be able to hit some really good chords. Okay, let's move along.
Yes,
so it's got a 5.78. So the actual, let's talk about the screen for a moment, because if you look at the screen side on, it kind of looks like on its own, it's like a super skinny phone. I'd say it's only about 5 mils, and I actually have a ruler here in front of me, so I can double check that. It's 5 to 6 millimeters thick, so really very, very skinny. A typical phone these days is about 8 mils thick, but it's long as well, so compared to a traditional phone. Now, the screen itself is 5.8 inches and pretty high resolution, but it is weird, having used it for a while, to go from a normal phone to going to this, because you're so used to holding a phone and just kind of tapping away at it and, you know, adding your own little poo emojis to conversation as you go along, and scrolling up and down. You don't do that kind of usage in the same way with this, because that clamshell keyboard really does get in the way, because you've got to hold it. It doesn't fold completely back upon itself. It's always open, just like the Scion Series 5 used to be. So yes, that's a slightly weird usage, which I'm still getting used to after a day and a half of using the product as my phone. As a phone itself, which is the other weird thing, if you want to make a phone call, obviously you've got to open it up, select the phone app and pick out the number, then close it again and then place it to your ear. So it's a slightly weird usage. Right, but I've been talking for long enough. People, ask me questions, please.
So as I remember, I think you just said it, but I just want to be clear. You can't use it in like a sort of slate mode, can you? You've got to have the keyboard open if you're accessing the screen, correct?
Correct.
So doesn't that get in the way? I remember testing this at CES and thinking, if you're playing like a game or something where you need access to swipe the edge of the screen kind of thing, it seemed to get in the way a bit. Have you found that when you're using apps or games or whatever?
Well, certainly you can start from the left-hand side of the screen to swipe. So in a way, I wouldn't say that's really it's a big problem, if I'm honest with you.
Yeah, but if something's on that side of the screen next to the keyboard, you know, if you're, well, I think, you know, a game at the moment where, you're having to hit something or swipe from that side, it just appeared to be awkward, that motion, when I remember having it in my hands.
You can start from pretty much the left hand. I mean, I'm putting my finger on the that little kind of that in between bit between the top of the keyboard and the start of the left of the screen. Your finger can go there. I don't see it as being okay. A problem, Barry. I think you'll be okay for whichever weird game you're using that forces you to use that motion.
Okay, so the other question I have then is typing speed. How is that comparable with a keyboard compared to the sort of lick you can get up to with a predictive keyboard?
Well, Barry, I'm very glad you asked me that question because before this podcast, I thought I'd better have some sort of comments on that. Okay, so I went to a website called typingtest.com and just followed it. And the first time I did it, I got to 31 words per minute, but I was being a bit careful. I was correcting words as I got them wrong. The second time I did it, I got to 43 words per minute. But that was with 5 errors, which took it down to 38 words, correct words per minute. By comparison, that was touch typing. So that's looking at the words as they appear on the screen and touching without looking down. By comparison, if I did that with my normal keyboard, I'm getting 68 words per minute with my not very accurate touch typing. But you asked how it compares to predictive text.
Yeah.
And there, it's really so close now. So I was just using the basic Google keyboard, and with again just trying to do it quickly as I might do in real life. I got 41 words per minute, but with 6 mistakes, which took it down to 35 correct words per minute. So that's only 3 less than the
fewer.
3 fewer than the Gemini PDA. So it's not a ringing endorsement for it there in terms of raw speed versus the other way of doing it.
Yeah, that was my hunch when I first saw this thing. I think it's an idea from 2000 that was fantastic in 2000, but the world has moved on and this thing hasn't. But the fact it still calls itself a PDA is illuminating in itself. So I'm going to cut to the chase and go, not, I'm afraid. Your witness.
Well, that's fine. I should say though, it does have quite... The reason why it calls itself a PDA is because it includes a number of potentially useful little tools that could help you. So if you think, I'm trying to think about how this would actually help to justify that. But it ties in less so a PDA actually, but more for a workhorse. So on this, it's an awful lot more for to be installed here than it does for a conventional screen. Because where you do have the advantage is if you want to put something precisely in, it's definitely better to have all the keys and the characters there, including the number row at the top, compared to having to use the on-screen keyboard. I can definitely see the advantage there. If you just want to make edits, for example, on a Word document, I'd far prefer to be using a keyboard screen than just relying on predictive text, if that makes sense.
Yeah, but it's the situations when you would use that, isn't it? It's the thing, if I'm going to settle down and start editing spreadsheets, by and large, I'm going to do it on a laptop or worse, my iPad. I don't ever see a desire to sort of do that kind of level of complex editing on a smartphone. And then it's the cases where you're going to be in a position to type, like, I don't know, but just for myself, if you're out on a train or standing at a football game or whatever, I'm not going to get a keyboard out and start fiddling around with a keyboard. You look a berk more than anything else. And so I can think a few situations where it's going to be of genuine advantage and many where it's going to be a disadvantage. And given that when the advantage is there, the speed difference is minimal, I don't see it.
Okay, Darren, you've been very quiet. Is that because you don't care?
Well, I've been trying to care. I really have. I've been looking at lots of pictures of the Gemini next to the old Scion Series 5. And the thing is, I mean, yeah, it's exactly like Barry says. In 2000, this was an exciting thing. I mean, in 2000, I had one in 1997 or so, because I had a fairly lengthy commute. And at the time, I had a really rubbishy, very early Motorola mobile phone. And I had nothing that I could play with and tinker with and, you know, write things on and play games on the train. I had access to a big chunky ThinkPad, but that was, you know, really not very convenient. And this was wonderful. It opened up all those vistas, all those possibilities. Nowadays, I'm really trying to picture when I would use the Gemini. I mean, I keep thinking, well, maybe, you know, if I were going on holiday, going away for a weekend, it'd be handy to have it. But then for 600 quid, you can get an iPad and a keyboard. And I think that's a more usable form factor. I don't think I need something this size, you know, which is slightly too big and chunky and awkward to be a phone and slightly too small to be a laptop. So I want to like it. Also, it doesn't have the that appealing kind of completely irregularly wonky keyboard that the original Series 5 did, that really didn't make it look like it had been knocked up by the boys in the lab. This looks a bit bland, to be honest. So I've been trying. I've been quiet because I've been trying to find a reason to like this, but I'm afraid I also, like Barry, I'm going to have to cut to the chase too late and say cold.
Okay. Well, before I open it up to everyone else, I'm just going to ask, because Michael Deere is very positive on Mixlr. So if you're still there, Michael, if you just want to do a quick word on why you actually want a phone with a keyboard, I will mention that in the closing arguments. The other thing is that it does dual boot to a distribution of Linux. I'm just trying to check here. I think it might be Debian, but
Debian,
I'm not. Sorry?
It's Debian, yeah.
So that does give it a full kind of mini computer power, which you can't get in other things. So in your pocket, you could theoretically have a computer. The other thing is that it's got a long-lasting battery. I haven't used it long enough to test, but this is a 4,200 milliamp hour, I believe, battery. So that's about, I don't know, typically you'll get about 3,000 in a phone. So this thing should last. Other things to say, it's not a great processor inside. It's a very middle-of-the-road processor. So in my tests so far, it got just under 5,000 in the multi-core Geekbench test, for example, if you know that, whereas the Apple iPhone 10 got about 10,000. That's about it. It comes with Wi-Fi. It comes with 4G, although they do say you can order a Wi-Fi work version, which costs. You can't currently order that. So at the moment, your choices are $599 for the one with 4G and Wi-Fi. That is probably the main thing to say. So let's do some rounds on Mixlr to see if anyone else apart from Michael Deere is going to say this is hot. If you cast your votes now, that would be great. I love the idea of this. Barry, you and I met them at CES. We talked to them, and I love the concept behind this. And I want it to be a success, to be honest with you. I want it to find its niche, and I'm just not quite convinced yet where that niche is. So if anyone wishes to send me a message to say, you know, maybe over Twitter to say where they think the niche is, I'm very open to ideas. So I'm actually leaning to not hot at the moment, I'm sorry to say. But I've only had it for a day and a half, so who knows, that may change. All right, so let's go to Mixlr. What are people saying there? We've got one hot for Michael Deere, standing alone. David Artis, it is hot at the original price, but not at this. It did come out, so if you back this on Indiegogo, you could get it for $399, if memory serves me, which is a slightly more palatable price. But Boster says cold. Peter Kaplan, cold. Russ Reed says sadly not. Kevin Rayner, also not. And I'm really struggling to find anyone with anything positive to say. Southend Sites, potential. So it's not looking great out there, because I'd say that probably our audience are the most likely buyers for this product. Anything to say, guys, as I just talk to myself?
It's all been said, Tim.
Give it up, man.
Okay. I'm gonna go for a final mini positive. Tower 99. I sometimes find it useful to have an extra small screen standing on my desk. If there is a budget version, I would consider it. Well, look out for the Wi-Fi version. And Michael says, I carry an old phone around to do my admin stuff remotely. I'd love a more up-to-date phone with a keyboard to allow me to upgrade, but I don't use the voice part of my phone. So probably two votes there for what was an older style version of the Psion 5MX, which would basically update the OS, but don't worry about the phone side of things, folks, and save us some money. All right. So final thing to say is that the issue is out on sale, went on sale last week. So look out for that. He said, trying to remember what was in the front cover. What was on the front cover, guys? Yeah, that's, yes. It had Dump Office writ large. So, a lovely feature there. So I'm just looking for it. What else is in it, Barry?
Oh, don't ask me. I only write the flipping thing. I don't read it.
Oh, here we go. Dump Office, Raspberry Pi, all new version, 13 secret skills of the Amazon Echo, build your own super cloud, Ubuntu Dell XPS 13, and the Reddit Enigma.
There you go.
Well done. All right. okay. All right, guys. Thank you very much, everyone, for listening. Until our podcast in 2 weeks' time, goodbye.
Bye. Bye.